Albert Einstein, and all of you will know who he is, said that the splitting of the atom has changed everything in our lives, save our mode of thinking. And he went on to say, and thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. But more and more of the people of the world are today realizing that humanity can get out of the mess it finds itself in by a change of consciousness, a new way of looking at life, and therefore a new way of living. This change must be away from looking at ourselves as separate from others, and therefore away from action based on selfishness and the interests of one person only. And that one person is usually ourselves. Have you ever watched your own thoughts? You will find that about 90% of them, some of you will fare better than that, but many of you could go above the 90%. 90% of your thoughts are based upon yourself, your security, what you're doing at the moment, your financial arrangements, your work, your social position, and so on and so on. And from this way of thinking comes a life based on competition. Yourself against the world, or sometimes it's the world against you. It's true that many of us have a loving and caring attitude towards members of our family, perhaps to our close friends or workmates. But what is needed is a mental attitude which is aware of the needs of every person, the welfare of humanity as a whole. And I think it's true to say that if our political and financial leaders could overnight, or by the wave of a magic wand, gain a new world view based on the principles of brotherhood, most of our troubles could be resolved by cooperation and understanding between factions and nations which are today in opposition. And I'd like to remind you, you probably know, that this society has for 100 years put forward the idea of the brotherhood of humanity. In fact, the brotherhood of all that lives, all that exists. And although some progress has been made, there is still a very long way to go, and some say a short time in which to achieve the end. But these leaders are entrenched in institutions which in turn are based on achieving the greatest gain for their own separate and particular interest. And they often gain at the expense of other interests and other people. I don't want to preach tonight, but I've got to say some of this to introduce my subject. Only some of the ideas are my own, but many have come from books like The Turning Point by that young physicist, Fritjof Capra. He says in his book, we have high inflation and unemployment, we have an energy crisis, a crisis in health care, pollution and other environmental disasters, a rising wave of violence and crime, the threat of nuclear war, and so on. And he says that all are different facets of one and the same crisis. And that is a crisis of perception, of the way we look at things and the way we feel about things. It derives from the fact that we are trying to apply the concepts of an outdated worldview to a reality that can no longer be understood in terms of those concepts. We live in a different world. Today we are globally interconnected, and it's a world in which biological, physiological, social, and environmental phenomena are all interdependent. To describe this world appropriately, we need a new vision of reality, a fundamental change in our thought perceptions and values. The beginnings of this change from mechanistic to the holistic conception of reality are already visible in a whole series of social movements emphasizing different aspects of the new vision of reality. And of course, this is going on to a very great extent in America, and California is the laboratory in which these new ideas are being worked out. When these movements recognize that their aims are the same, they will flow together and form a powerful force for social change, which is likely to result in transformation of unprecedented dimensions, a turning point for the planet as a whole. Now, many of these individuals, as I said, are in America, but they are throughout the world as well. And they are experiencing themselves this process of change. And this is described very well in the book called The Aquarian Conspiracy by Marilyn Ferguson, who is a transpersonal psychologist and the editor of the Mind and Brain Bulletin. Conspiracy means breathing together. And in this case, it means an intimate joining for the benevolent purpose of personal and cultural transformation. Personal and cultural transformation. She made a request, an appeal, to various people she knew to get their opinion of what was happening. And she got a surprising number of entries, of answers, from advanced thinkers, scientists, celebrities, and ordinary people, who all found they had the same purpose, which was to change themselves from the inside outwards and thus bring about a revolution in consciousness, which would inevitably lead, they felt, to dramatic social and economic change. She envisages that this turnabout in consciousness in a critical number of individuals will form a network powerful enough to produce radical change in our culture. Now, the critical number is the hundredth, or the millionth, monkey if you like, or person. And when this number is reached, the energy will push things forward past that critical point, and transformation will proceed at a much greater pace. This change will flow from new perceptions, which in turn comes from a higher dimension of thought. And this new dimension of thought is beyond that which is normally available to humanity. H.P. Blavatsky, the founder or one of the founders of the Theosophical Society, made the statement way back 100 years ago, the importance of which we're only slowly realizing. She said, we share one consciousness. humanity and all living things have their root in universal mind. Or you can call it nature, if you like. Or you can call it God. This divine intelligence holds the pattern of our evolutionary future, as it also holds our past. And the two come together and react upon one another in the present moment. And this is what's happening at this present moment. This intelligence sets the stage for each step forward in the evolution of consciousness. And today the stage is brilliantly lit. There is stress on that stage. And there is a waiting expectantly for a sufficient number of human beings to know their inner selves, to know in their inner selves what is required to respond by positive, focused thought to that new impetus. And this change will come about at the level of where the level of thought links with the dynamic power of feeling, and then action must follow. When thought and feeling, heart and mind are fused and work as one, then right action must follow. The Chinese, as I said in my previous lecture, know about these things, or the ancient Chinese knew about these things, and that they said that the movement is natural, arising spontaneously. For this reason, the transformation of the old becomes easy. The old is discarded and the new is introduced. Both measures accord with time, and therefore no harm results. And when we look at our present-day world, we hope the Chinese were right. I should add that when this happens, a step forward is taken. Sufficient numbers of beings in the world have read the message from the divine intelligence, and a change and forward movement is inevitable, in spite of the apparent obstacles. In the complexity of human civilization, the number is substantial that is required for this change, to bring about this change. But in the world of the animals, as I will shortly tell you, only one monkey was needed to develop a new perception which changed the life pattern of the whole group in its immediate neighborhood. And when a certain number, say 100, had learnt the new activity, that knowledge spread to others of the same species, so far distant that there was no possibility of learning by imitation. Now, the story of the 100th monkey is given in full in Lifetide by Lyle Watson, and is mentioned, I think, in many other books today. I understand it was shown in detail by David Attenborough. It is David, isn't it? Not Richard. Richard was the Gandhi man, wasn't he? By David Attenborough in the TV series Life on Earth. But I'm going to quote the story as given in the book The 100th Monkey by Ken Keyes Jr., author of The Handbook of Higher Consciousness and several other books. I'll read this to you. I couldn't do better than just read it. It's very well and clearly put. There is a phenomenon I'd like to tell you about. In it may lie our only hope for a future for our species. Here is the story of the 100th monkey. The Japanese monkey, Macaca fascata, has been observed in the wild for a period of over 30 years. In 1952, on the island of Koshima, scientists were providing monkeys with sweet potatoes dropped in the sand. The monkeys liked the taste of the raw sweet potatoes, but they found the dirt unpleasant, as we would. An 18-month-old female named Emo found she could solve the problem by washing the potatoes in a nearby stream. Notice she was 18 months old, which is quite young. She taught this trick to her mother. Her playmates also learned the new way, and they taught their mothers too. This cultural innovation was gradually picked up by various monkeys before the eyes of the scientists. Between 1952 and 1958, all the young monkeys learned to wash the sandy sweet potatoes to make them palatable. Only the adults who imitated their children learned this social improvement. Other adults kept eating the dirty sweet potatoes. Then something startling took place. In the autumn of 1958, a certain number of Koshima monkeys were washing sweet potatoes. The exact number is not known. Let us suppose that when the sun rose one morning, there were 99 monkeys on Koshima Island who had learned to wash their sweet potatoes. Let's further suppose that later that morning, the 100th monkey learned to wash potatoes. Then it happened. By that evening, everyone in the tribe was washing sweet potatoes before eating them. The added energy of this 100th monkey somehow created an ideological breakthrough. But notice, the most surprising thing observed by these scientists was that the habit of eating sweet potatoes then spontaneously jumped over the sea. Colonies of monkeys on other islands and the mainland troops of monkeys at Takashikayama were washing their sweet potatoes. Thus, when a certain critical number achieves an awareness, this new awareness may be communicated from mind to mind. Although the exact number may vary, the 100th monkey phenomenon, as it is called today, means that when only a limited number of people know of a new way, it may remain the consciousness property of those people. But there is a point at which, if only one more person tunes in to a new awareness, a field is strengthened so that this awareness reaches almost everyone. The experiments of J.B. Ryan of Duke University have demonstrated repeatedly that individuals can communicate private information to each other, although located in different places. We now know that the strength of this extrasensory communication can be amplified to a powerfully effective level when the consciousness of the 100th person is added. What Ken Keyes calls extrasensory communication seems to me to be a function of consciousness at a higher level, having more general or wider scope than limited human consciousness. At its highest level, it is what I call the universal mind. Some today are relating this to what Jung, the psychologist, called collective unconscious. But the term collective consciousness, which is also being used, is probably a better one. Anyway, the story of the 100th monkey reinforces the idea that the universal mind functions at lesser holes within itself, each lesser hole having a specialized purpose while still being part of the overriding wholeness, the universal mind. This is the basis of holism, started or proposed as a theory by General Smuts early in this century. A hierarchy of energy fields each part of a more inclusive wholeness, of which each is a part. You can think of a nest of tables, each the same, one a little bigger and sitting on top of the other. Or you can think of the Russian doll, you know, the sort that has a big painted woman as a doll. You unscrew the top and you pick out another similar doll inside, unscrew that top and there's another one, and so it goes on. The important point in holism is that the larger whole is something more than the sum of its parts. You can't know the nature of a car by looking at the carburetor only. Nor, for that matter, can you know the nature of a car unless you drive it and know what it can do. This concept of the whole having qualities beyond those of the parts often takes us into a world beyond that which is subject to experiment and measurement. And therefore, it eliminates the possibility... The possibility of the existence of an overriding universal mind cannot be accepted by those scientists, and they are the majority of scientists, who depend entirely upon experimental proof and measurement for their understanding. However, there are one or two scientists braving the scorn of their fellows and using intuitive understanding, who have evolved theories about intelligent guidance within nature. One of these is Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. He's a member of the society, incidentally, and I met him in Adyar, about the headquarters of the society in India, about 18 months ago. His recently published book is called A New Science of Life. In it, he sets out a non-material theory based on what he calls morphogenetic fields. He says specific morphogenetic fields are responsible for the characteristic form and the organization of systems at all levels of complexity, not only in the realm of biology, but also in chemistry and physics. In this concept of formative causation, the overriding field provides the archetypal pattern as a germ, which, programmed like a computer, specifies for the organism orthogenetic goals and controls its progress towards them. Now, most interesting that this book should have been produced now, because it fits in very well with the whole concept of the 100th monkey and the transformation that is taking place in the world. A little bit earlier, another scientist, Dr. Alan Lovelock, fellow of the Royal Society, evolved an even more comprehensive theory of overriding intelligence, which he called the Gaia. I understand this is the Greek for, you can translate it as, Mother Nature. Or there may be other ways of doing it. But anyway, that's good enough for my purpose. His theory is that all living things, including matter, the air, the oceans, and land surfaces, are part of a giant system which, during the evolutionary process, was able to control temperature, the composition of the atmosphere and other elements, exactly, and note the word, exactly as needed for the development of life during the 35 million years of the Earth's existence. And those of you who have read these things will know, my knowledge is not very good, but I do know that, first of all, the Earth was hot, fire was the principal element, then, using nitrogen, there was actually produced water, and life began in the water and came from the water onto the land when it had cooled down, and so on. But in all those stages of evolution, an exact balance of conditions was required. And so the author rejects the concept of sheer chance and says, life defines the material conditions needed for its survival and makes sure that they stay there. And if we equate life with mind or intelligence, we are nearing the concept of an overriding universal field which has within it lesser fields controlling the life of every species of living thing. We can see, therefore, that it was such an intelligent control that led the monkeys to wash their sweet potatoes. And when the idea was grasped by the few, it expanded by the sufficient number, the critical number, the 100. It expanded throughout the species because all in that species are under the same overriding, controlling intelligence. That, to me, seems to be the explanation. With man, it's a little more difficult, as we will soon see. But it's interesting to note that the washing of the sweet potatoes was first learnt by a teenage monkey. The young today have been born into the new energies of the changing world, and they can read the messages being beamed by divine intelligence to help them towards a better way of living, better than we older people can, because they are less conditioned. But they have great difficulties in a world where the stable values we older people knew are being eroded. We, and those who went before us, have created the world they have inherited. As early as the mid-1950s, psychologist Robert Lindner touched off controversy by his prophetic warning. Into them, the younger generation, we have bred our fears and insecurities. Upon them we have foisted our mistakes and misconceptions. In our stead, they are expressing the unrelieved rage, the tension, and the terrible frustration of the world which they were born into. They are imprisoned by the blunders and delusions of their predecessors, and like all prisoners, they are mutineers in their hearts. Unfortunately, we can see this happening in the world today. And J.B. Priestley, the novelist, warned that we must stop the dehumanizing, depersonalizing process which is taking the spiritual dimension out of our lives, inducing the anesthesia which demands violence, cruelty, horrible effects to feel anything at all. And if you watch some of the programs and films today that we have, you will see that many of the young require loud noises, violence, and psychedelic colors before that particular program has any interest for them. So it is essential that we decide now whether we want our descendants, our own or others, it's all the same, to have some feeling for the principles of friendship, peace, or whether we support by inaction the terrible atrocities being inflicted on innocent people all over the world. It is spreading fast. Today, 10 and 11-year-olds are being taught to hate and kill by television. They will be among the leaders in the next 20 years or so, if the human race lasts that long. Australia and New Zealand can and must show the world that human beings, by general decent relationships, can join together and refuse to be overruled by the power structures of governments and international financiers and anti-life technology. Now, these last few quotations came from Bill Buck, who is the founder of the Millionth Monkey Club, which started last year in Queensland, and the aims are set out in those remarks and also in what I will read now. I am a member of that club. There are some in, I think there is a representative in Wellington, but I have some literature on it if any of you would like to see it afterwards. Anyway, Bill Buck goes on to say, the 100th monkey phenomena, describing the reality of the collective consciousness, is instinctive in all life forms. And I think every student of theosophy will subscribe entirely with what he says. We, unfortunately, because of our cultural and sociological programming, have lost this sense and cannot equate the principles to our own abilities. It is for this reason the club has been formed. It will enable us to demonstrate by the most practical means that we do care for the well-being of life values. Ken Keyes, when he wrote this book, The Millionth Monkey, had the same purpose in mind. He makes it quite clear that he doesn't mind who uses the book. It is not copyrighted. He says, when enough of us are aware of something, all of us become aware of it. The appreciation and love we have for ourselves and others creates an expanding energy field that becomes a growing power in the world. There is no need to feel helpless or get paralyzed by hopelessness. We can join together and raise our voices in unison. There is more power in numbers than we ever hoped to dream about. I'm quoting entirely now from to the end of my lecture from that book. He goes on, this book does not deal with petty matters. It tells how to operate our lives and our world. It tells us how to stay alive. Much of the book deals powerfully about the dangers confronting mankind, from the pollution of our environment and from the dangers of nuclear power and nuclear bombs. So I'm going to confine myself to a few of his quotations, all of which are powerful. If you get the book and read the book, you can find it expressed in much more detail. The explosion of one megaton bomb generates 10 to the power of 32, one with 32 noughts after it, molecules of nitrogen oxygen, which lifted to 70,000 feet above the Earth, eat away the ozone and let in the ultraviolet light in the sunlight, which the ozone layer normally screens out. The explosion within a short period, a few days, of 50% of the nuclear weapons available today would take out 70% of the ozone screen in the northern hemisphere and 40% in the southern hemisphere. And I understand that the safe maximum for human life is about 20%, so this would go a long way past it. Man might be able to protect himself by keeping out of the sun or wearing dark glasses, but you can easily understand that the animals and the insects cannot. They would become blind and die. And the insects, for instance, would not be able to pollinate our fruit, our crops, our trees. And the whole ecological system would break down. And this is quite apart from nuclear fallout and those dangers, and from bomb blast itself. Secondly, in 1964, the Atomic Energy Commission showed that a serious nuclear accident and a conventional bomb thrown by a terrorist could do this, would kill 45,000 people. In 1958, a Russian nuclear installation exploded at Kishtin and devastated the countryside for hundreds of miles. This area in the Ural Mountains is now a wasteland, which cannot be inhabited for thousands of years. The US government was told about this by the CIA, but the report was held secret for 20 years and was only brought to light when the Information Act was passed. Three, people of the Earth are spending $1 million per minute on armaments. A nuclear war can end the way we live It cannot be won, it can only be lost, says Ken Keyes. In a crash of an Air Force plane in 1961 in Carolina, the 24 megaton bomb aboard did not explode, but there were six fail-safe mechanisms for stopping it explode in those circumstances. Five of them failed and one held. And there are many cases of the breakdown of computers, and just by a whisker has mankind been saved. As he says in one place, a 45-cent piece in a computer went wrong. A little, tiny little thing, and the alarm, the whatever, the alert was given. When we even maintain a supply of nuclear bombs as a deterrent, we are dangerously perpetuating the illusion that our safety and security lie in nuclear materials. And that's the end of my quotes from Ken Keyes. I've thought a lot about this concept of nuclear deterrent. And although I do not have strong convictions in this matter, I keep wondering, how can the build-up of weapons end? And the deterrent is based on fear, and fear is a denial of love and brotherhood. No. I think this is something we should all think about. And you know that the number of protests are increasing throughout the world. Admittedly, they're helping the communist cause, but I don't know. We ought to evaluate all these things for ourselves. Now, Ken Keyes goes on to ask, how can we reach enough people in time to avoid the ruin of planet Earth? Will you accept your share of the responsibility for creating the 100th monkey energy that will change the consciousness of the entire planet? Can we learn to keep our squabbles within bounds? At least, we can learn to disagree without throwing each other out of our hearts, because when we do this, we create rock-like hatreds. Can you say to a person, as I've heard so often said in Australia, I don't like always what you say or what you do, but I still understand and love you? We can become skillful at changing the desire systems in our minds. We can learn to feel love and compassion for the people involved in perpetuating nuclear technology, even when they're unwilling to understand the reasons for our concern. Can we do this? Do the protesters do it? Always remember that feelings of anger and hatred are separativeness, and that is our only problem, because brotherhood is the solution. Let us not try to save the world by increasing the problem of separativeness. Only by opening our minds and hearts will we find the rich, intuitive wisdom that lies within every human being. Even if it's not being used, it is there. The conflicting energies in our world are so great today that perhaps we need the millionth monkey to project the energy of wholeness and cooperation, of friendship and love, of sharing life on this planet together. Whatever that critical number may be, 100, or in the case of human beings, 1 million, you are needed to save our civilization. Appoint yourself as a roving ambassador of the state of love and loving and caring. Will you accept your share of the responsibility for creating the 100th monkey energy that will change the consciousness of the entire planet? We can tilt the scales to eliminate the awesome threat of nuclear catastrophe and environmental ruin. Be informed, hopeful, and energetic. Be vigilant with your thoughts of peace and love. Sense your power to lift the mood of despair. Let your enthusiasm seep in and penetrate the collective unconscious. I'm sorry. Let your enthusiasm seep in and penetrate the collective conscious, the collective consciousness, the universal mind, that overriding power in our lives, that which joins us all together. And you may be surprised, as you try to do this, how much you can accomplish.